Akron, Ohio. This is episode 192 of On the Tropes. On this week's episode, we are going to talk about the trope framing device and our top five favorite framing devices. But first, as always, I'm your host, Nick, and today I'm joined by...
Sir.
Eva.
And Kyle.
So framing device is a literary device. What are your guys' favorite literary devices? I'll go first while you guys think, unless you have one like right.
Oh, I do, actually.
Okay. All right.
Pen and inkwell.
What's... Like an actual device.
Oh, I was going to say a book light. That would be my favorite literary device.
Cause I don't like either of you.
I knew what you meant.
What is your favorite literary device?
Dramatic irony.
That's a good one. Hmm. I'm kind of I like illusions.
Mm-hmm.
Like with an A. Illusions. I have a least favorite. It's alliteration.
Mm.
I'm not an alliteration guy.
For like the title of the book or just whenever
anything.
People
I mean it's okay sometimes it'll just happen but
Alton Brown uses alliteration all the time and it's incredible.
Nick says alliteration.
Yeah, see, I don't like that.
Nick notes no on
see, I'd rather
on alliteration.
Nick says alliteration is dumb. that's my headline. What about you? Do you have a real favorite
song? No, I'm just going to quote Michael Bolton from Office Space and just say, you know, I just kind of like them all.
What about you, Kyle?
With like backstories or whatever. I don't know like what a,
Kyle
like
can't
the definition.
Read.
Yeah,
I don't
read.
Well, yeah, you guys went to a Waldorf
read good.
Store, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Waldorf store. Fill your mind with the devil's teachings.
I really learned how to read late. I had to get tutored and everything. So
it wasn't just you.
Yeah. Oh, at Waldorf.
Yeah, they're like against it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that it's just like.
Well, they think it's like that kids at like a young age don't process what they're reading. Yeah. Is something like that.
Like Leah, I think learned before me, and she's 3 years younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It just makes you better citizens for the world, though.
Mm-hmm.
So. Does it?
I don't know. I hope.
I don't know about that. Before we start talking about framing devices, I have to bring up, are you guys familiar with a singer named Lana Del Rey?
Mm-hmm.
She's a new album out called Norman Effing. Like, I think the title is actually Norman Effing. I'm not censoring it. Rockwell.
Yeah.
But she covers the Sublime song, Doin' Time.
Uh-oh.
So,
this is our
weekly Sublime update.
Yep. Man, Lana Del Rey, she had like a huge like cult-like following when she came out, it seemed. And I think she's another one of the artists that's kind of like reinvented herself a bunch of times. And I thought Video Games was pretty good. The one single.
That like 1960s Priscilla Presley aesthetic does nothing for me.
But what about the 1990s Sublime Illusions?
Nah.
It's like you don't have cigarette butts in your oven?
No. Out of all the horrifying things I just found in my new oven, cigarette butts was not one of them.
Other Sublime fan tropes.
Yeah. So let us know your favorite Sublime-related things from this week at onthetropes@gmail.com. In the meantime, we're going to be talking about framing devices. Eva, this was your idea.
It's true.
What is a framing device?
A framing device is a way of establishing a story that we usually have either a character from within the story, like kind of later on recounting something that's happened, or there's like more of a third person one where it's a person reading a book or reading a letter or composing a letter to somebody else, where we start like on one level and then we go into where we spend most of our time in that story. And sometimes we come back at the end. Sometimes it dips in and out.
Sometimes there's a story within a story within a story.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Which is the, I believe if we're using Inception as a metaphor, it's the snow chapter where they're all in snowsuits.
Is that the third?
It might be the fourth. I don't know. That movie, there's a lot.
There's a lot going on.
There's a lot of dreams in that movie.
And the thing of it is now the author of the story isn't really telling us anymore. Now one of the characters is doing it, which the TV Tropes page says sets up like an unreliable narrator. We're not getting an objective view of what happened. We're getting this person's version of what happened.
Yeah. And I like that. It lets, I mean, if it's written well, then it should be, it should feel like its own distinct perspective compared to the bigger story.
Are there many that on your lists that you really thought could be like biased to where you thought, well, this probably isn't what actually happened. This is just how this person is remembering it, or this is how this person wants other people to see it.
It's a, for me, that's something I actually really don't like in stories. I'm resistant to this.
To the unreliable narrator or to framing devices?
And I always have been. The unreliable narrator.
Because how can you believe, how can you get into a story without...
And I think we've even had conversations, I know I have with everybody here, just about, I feel like what's placed in front of us on screen is what happened. And that's what we have to go off of. I think that there are some, you know, there's some interesting ways you can play around with that. However, it's really hard to pull off effectively to me. So I feel like a lot of times when there is an unreliable narrator, sometimes it's just like either comes off as lazy writing, or in the probably more rare cases is an excuse for it.
Yeah, I like those tropes. I like anything in stories, not always, but when it's done well, that kind of points at the fictional nature of the work itself, or something that's commenting on fact versus fiction, like reality versus fantasy. I like that type of thing. So I think having an unreliable narrator, so that you have this outer story and then the inner story, you're not even sure like how much of that's real, how much of that's embellished. I think that's interesting. I like that dynamic.
I have a couple unreliable narrators, and one of them I like a lot just because it takes a more comedic side of it. Mm-hmm. It's actually two people telling a story at once, and so they tell it in and they're not exactly friends, so it's they take an interesting way of it.
Realize that there's something on my list that I didn't, that should be on my list that I didn't put.
I bet I know what it is.
It's probably my number three.
Is it a Japanese movie?
That's what I predicted.
to the point where I had to literally throw my hands up in the air that I didn't think of it.
It was funny because I thought the same thing. I almost said it when Kyle was, I was like, oh, wait.
No, mine's not.
Okay. Yeah. Is that on your list?
No, it's not.
Okay. All right. Well, let's just talk about it. Rashomon, I think, is probably the best example of what we're talking about. Not just a framing device, but a framing device with varying degrees of unreliable narrators, and it's all the same story. It's just how the people involved, it's the three people involved and then an independent observer, how they all perceive the story that happened basically the same way, only with slight tweaks, and how certain people are at different degrees of culpable or victims in the story. But what I think is also cool about that movie is that there's a fifth version. It's the bandit, the samurai who gets killed, the woman who I think, depending on your interpretation, is either raped or seduced by the bandit. I think is a farmer who sees it. But then at the end, there's a fifth person, and that's you. Mm-hmm. So there's all these different vantage points that you can see the story from, and it's like a lot of people have pulled from that. I think there's a movie called Vantage Point that stole that.
I wonder how many Rashomon like remakes and homages there actually are. It's really a lot.
I feel like it was a device on sitcoms a lot when we were younger. Something would happen and then everybody's telling their version of what happened.
The Rashomon episode is the thing. I bet there's a TV Tropes page for it.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. But I like that those narrators are all unreliable, or maybe they're all reliable and they're just seeing things. I mean, who's to say which of those stories is real, if any of them are real, or maybe all of them are real. But I like that debate and discussion that you can
have. It's the same way we interact with when we watch a movie.
Yeah.
Each of us has a very, very individual reaction to it. And the things that stick out to us, the things that are important to us, the things that bother us. And so that's how language works, and that's how stories are shared and changed.
And what I like about Rashomon specifically so much is it doesn't ever try to answer that question of which of these actually happened. And it's the sort of thing now where, like, if that movie were to come out now, there'd be like a million Reddit threads that are like, well, this is the one that actually happened, and here's the clue, because like the guy's whatever watch was on this hand and not on that hand, or what, you know, something dumb like that, where they're trying to figure out the answer.
Right answer.
They need an answer. Yeah.
And it's, the movie's not searching for like a factual truth. It's searching for like a, you know, a metaphorical or cosmic truth.
And I think that's what bothers me about some of the unreliable narrator conversations, is occasionally I feel like it's probably more the fans that bug me.
Yeah.
And it's the assuming that narrators are unreliable and we have no reason to think so, or things like that always bug me.
We need the authority figure of the writer to tell us which one's the right one. And even if it's then, a character, like, then we're suspicious.
Well, even then, though, it bugs me a lot when you hear the canon or you hear what the writer thought, and then people are still like speculating. Yeah. And it's like, well, we've heard what the originator of the story.
See, I don't
like,
believe. So. I don't believe in that. I think we've talked about this maybe.
Yeah,
in passing,
I think that's
before.
Where we've like definitely had.
Yeah, I don't.
As soon as the writer says this is how something is, that's how it is.
Yeah, and I feel like I don't. The writer's opinion isn't any better than mine, except he spent more time with it. But I think once it's out there, it doesn't
invalidate yours.
Yeah, it's everyone's. Mm.
So, do you have Robert E. Howard?
I don't have anything.
Okay. I think in the same way that.
If I may, real quick, I like to think that his name is not Robert E., but his first name is Robert E.
Robert E. Howard, yeah.
He would like that because it sounds like robber. In the same way that a framing device can create a suspicion of the unreliable narrator, Robert E. Howard, and I think Edgar Rice Burroughs did it too, probably many other writers from that period, use a framing device to make it seem more real. To make it seem accurate, true. Mm-hmm. But Robert E. Howard, I know for Conan he did, and I think for some of his other stories, will tell a story at the beginning of his story about how, like with Conan, it was that Conan came into his house at night. He had this like feeling that somebody was behind him, and it was Conan, and Conan compelled him to, you know, write down what he was telling him. You know, he had to tell this tale to him, and he was only writing what the dude told him, the guy with the axe behind him was telling him to write. And he just wrote it all down, and that's what you're going to read. And he didn't have anything to do with it. He's just like an honest reporter. So when you have like a story that's a letter or a case file of some kind, it makes it seem more truthful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Edgar Rice Burroughs had a device where he would say that he was related to... like John Carter and A Princess of Mars, like his long lost uncle that gave him these manuscripts, and it's interesting because I think you were talking about John Carter on social media the other day, right? Yeah,
it was on TV the other day.
I think that movie completely holds. I think it's a very good film in some ways.
What,
yeah,
what I said on Facebook was, and it's not related to the movie at all, like it doesn't have to be related to the movie itself, but I walked into the doctor's office and somebody is watching that, like just sitting around watching that on TV, and almost always it's Fox News, so it's like a refreshing change from this dystopian hellscape that's the physician's lounge.
Yeah, and I noticed though that the movie tried it. They tried to keep that framing device of like it's his relative. Man, it fell completely flat in a film. Like
it doesn't happen until the end, does it? They don't set it up at the beginning at all, do they?
It's bookended.
Like, I didn't remember the beginning
and then right at the end, and it's like on screen. There's no suspension of disbelief possible. It's just like it totally didn't work, and it's like,
it doesn't always work. I mean, I think Saving Private Ryan bookends that movie, and it's like,
yeah,
you don't need that.
Yeah,
You could totally do without it.
Yeah,
that's literally a commercial.
Yeah, the good stuff's in the middle.
Yeah.
All right, should we jump on our top fives?
Sure.
Kyle, what's your number five?
I thought this tape was gonna be a conversation stimulator, man. I was gonna ask you for your top five records to play on a Monday morning and all that, and you just had to f***ing ruin it. Hope we'll do it next Monday. No! I wanna do it now!
My number five is a game by Onion Games called Dandy Dungeon Legend of Brave Yomada, and it's basically just a simple dungeon crawler, but what's unique about this game is that it's being designed by Yomada-kun while you're playing it. He's like this wannabe programmer. He's kind of a goofy guy, but as he plays through the dungeons and as people come through his apartment and talk to him, or a cute girl moves in next door, he like is updating his game and adding these elements to it. And I think it's cool that it's like a game within a game or a story within a story. And You see it start off really simple and kind of plain, and as he meets people and interacts with people, the game becomes a little more like deep and has more elements to it. So it's kind of cool to see that type of, I guess it's a framing device. It's like a game within a game, which I guess could be like a story within a story. So, and a game like this, it started off as an iOS game, but now it's on the Switch. So that's where I was able to play it. It's pretty cool. Eva, what'd be your number five?
My number five is Freaks. I'm just going to get it out of the way now. Freaks begins at the end of the story, some considerable amount of time after the story. And it's a group of people at a sideshow, and they've presumably paid the extra money to see the thing in the pit at the end. And the talker is there kind of setting up what they're about to see. Everyone gasps, and he says, well, she wasn't always like this. She was once the peacock of the air. And then we go backward to the rest of the story.
That's awesome.
And I think it's easy with that one to forget that it, you know, where we go, you know, how we end up back into the pit at the end, but then it comes back.
Yeah, that one is, it makes you get, you kind of forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really shocking at the end. It's a good reveal.
Have we done the trope, like just nonlinear storytelling in general?
I think so.
We must have. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
Cause you don't like it, right, Nick? When they like go like, oh yeah, here's what, you know, here's what happened a year ago, or is it just the 6 weeks ago like that?
It depends on how it's done.
Would that be a literary device I could like?
It could be.
Woo.
If it's
got one,
yeah.
If it's done well, it's like anything. If it's done well, I think it can work. Mm-hmm. But then, so many people tried to like emulate Pulp Fiction after that came out. So every crime movie for the next 10 years had some kind of like
back and forth,
yeah, non-linear thing. And then I do kind of, I'm resistant to the 6 weeks later title card or
earlier.
Yeah, I feel like for the most part you should be able to tell the story without having those.
It's possible, certainly.
Yeah. And some people complain if it's not clear, like Manchester by the Sea is told non-linearly, so it's bouncing back and forth, and some people had a tough time following it and thought it was disorienting, but I kind of thought that was part of the story itself.
Does his facial hair change? Is that how you know?
I don't think so.
He's wearing glasses to show the time.
Sir, what's your number five?
So my number five is The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. It's part of the King Killer Chronicle. Kind of the new, this decade's big fantasy series that's taking forever to write. I started reading, actually, the first one came out in 2007. And it's really great. And it's like, it plays with different narrative structures. The first half of it is like third person. Second half is told by the character Kvothe, who's like this, imagine it's almost kind of like Harry Potter, in that it's a young guy, fantasy world that's growing up and he's learned to become a sorcerer and a magician over time. Yet it's like really gritty, very realistic, really like, Rothfuss has a really good eye for, really good ear for writing like personal relationships into this stuff. So really generic fantasy novel on the outside, and then it's actually like really interesting and really cool. So yeah, The Name of the Wind, Patrick Rothfuss. He wrote the first two, and I think the last one came out almost 6-7 years ago now, I think.
I think this was the book I started reading. I've tried to read it several times. Does it start with people in an inn?
Yeah.
Telling a story. Yep. Mm-hmm. I've tried to read. I've read the first 30 pages probably like 5 or 6 times, and I just like for some reason can't get past that. But it is interesting. I just get distracted with something else.
Yeah, it's like.
But I've heard. This I've is heard one the comparisons first and I've thought heard,
of for this trope because of how much it uses set like a couple of different kinds of framing device like within the same novel. And
yeah, that's cool.
Nick, what is your number five?
Well, my number five is the first thing that I thought of when thinking about this trope, and it's Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel.
Mm.
And one thing I like about this framing device, so it starts off with the girl and she sees a statue of some author, and then that goes into the story of the author, who tells a story about him when he's much younger. And each of those different stories has a different aspect ratio. So not only are you getting a different story, but it's being presented visually in a different way. So I just think that's a cool way the movies can do that, where something like a book doesn't have that
capability.
Yeah. That's it doesn't have like the visual stylistic changes that movies can do. So I like that movie and I like the way it does that. Kyle, what's your number four?
My number four is Tales from the Borderlands by Telltale Games. And in the beginning of this game, the two main characters, Reese and Fiona, are like bound and kidnapped, and they're just telling the story of what happened up until that point. And this is the comedic, unreliable narrator story that I was talking about earlier, where they're not exactly friends and they're telling the story. And I think there are occasional parts where I think they tell the same story twice, and you see both aspects of it, like where one is the hero and the other one isn't. But I think it's a cool way to tell the story, and I think it's handled in the same way that Memento is, where you think that the black and white part of Memento is the, like, we won't catch up at all, but then mm-hmm. that turns into present day at some point. And it's really interesting. You don't really see this very often in Telltale games. They're pretty straightforward for the most part. But this was a unique take on it, so I like that a lot. Eva, would be your number four?
My number four is I Walked with a Zombie. And it begins with a character saying the title of the film. And she's... we get a voiceover of her that goes back to, you know, back to Canada, where she receives this assignment to go to this island and take care of a sick person. And there's a little bit of her narration, and then it just disappears from the film. And not until the ending scene do we get another voice, a man's voice who we haven't heard. He's not a character that we've met in the film before at all, but he kind of wraps it up with a prayer for the people who have died in the film, and, you know, kind of hoping for the people who are still living. It's just really kind of odd. And that's one that you completely forget about, because it seems like the movie forgot about it also, mm-hmm. to just like keep it going. Or maybe it gets to the point in the film where, like, we catch up to her like midway, kind of like Forrest Gump, where part of it is a flashback and then we catch up to present time and go forward. Because the movie's kind of unclear about what zombie she's talking about.
That's a Tornero movie, isn't it?
Yes.
He does a similar thing in Out of the Past, where it's a story, and then halfway through, but maybe 10 or 15 minutes in, he tells a story that's like half of the movie, and then you catch back up to present day, and then it's the rest of it. So he's I haven't seen A Walk with a Zombie. I've only seen, I think, three of his movies, but it's one of them you need to check out, because I like all his other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth checking out for sure. It's good.
No other Hollywood movie of its time talks about slavery the way I Walked with a Zombie mm-hmm. does.
Mm-hmm. I've actually, for Halloween, for Scary Movie Trivia, I've got a question coming up. Nice. It's a Tornare feline movie, this or that.
I saw that.
And it's basically just like a plot description. Is this cat people or leopard man? And it's something like, if you've seen either of those, you'll definitely know.
I just realized I have a like a 10 point question for that if somebody can answer it this word.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
10 points.
Tell us off air, unless do we want to just say it, and if people happen to listen to the show, then good for them.
They get
the point.
They can see you at trivia night and earn those 10 points.
What is it?
Let me think about what's the name of the book.
Black Alibi.
The Black Alibi, right? So the leopard man is based on this like 1950s, like 40s hard-boiled mystery, like murder mystery called The Black Alibi. And it's like, essentially, the leopard man killer turns out to be a serial killer who's using these huge claws to like kill his victims. And that's not even the most amazing part that would be hard to do now, is it's a cop.
Jeez.
So yeah, if they can guess
What's the Black Alibi would be
Black Alibi question. Is the name of the book, yeah. So what book is Leprechaun based on?
Okay.
And if anybody can answer that, God.
Well, either of those two movies, if you know the source material for either one.
The source material for Cat People, it's even more incredible.
Cat People was a story that Val Lewton wrote for Weird Tales in the 1930s called The Bagheeda.
I have that copy.
As do I. So, all of mine are horror movies also, because I felt like we had to like start leading into,
easing into
Halloween.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, and the story of Cat People, the one we need, the movie version we need, is an incredible story, because it's like this village of people discovered by the Nazis that are, and they're all like werewolves, essentially.
Nice. Sir, what's your number four?
So my number four is Michael Crichton's 1976 novel, Eaters of the Dead, the manuscript of Ibn Fadlan relating his experiences with the Northmen in AD 1922. Later republished and made into a film with the horribly unfortunate title, The 13th Warrior. This is just The 13th Warrior was a movie I loved as a kid, and this was like one of the first books that I like searched out to read the actual novel of it, and it's just awesome. The novel is way better than the movie, which I think is kind of fun. Yet what's cool about it is I think more so than a lot of other framing devices that I've read, this one is so effective. It really, really does feel like it's just this guy and his travel letters. I actually have a couple of the Arab travel books, like through Africa and through some of the like Eastern areas, and like they're just great. They're like filled with action and this like really fit. So Eaters of the Dead, it's one of my favorite ones. Nick, what is your number four?
My number four is the framing device used in the Coen Brothers movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is the Netflix movie from last year. And their framing device, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, is six different vignettes. And each one starts and stops with a book being opened up. And I think the book is called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And it shows like the first page of the book, like as the pages are turned, and the description of the words that you see on the page are actually like setting the scene up, and it gives it kind of like this classic Western feeling to it. And then that allows them to kind of go in and do their own like distinctly Coen-y kind of bleak, absurdist take on the Western. Not all the stories are as good as the others, but especially I think the first one is just so fun. Like, Tim Blake Nelson is Buster Scruggs.
Well, you said it. It's just really fun to watch.
He's so silly. He's very like loquacious,
yeah.
And he sings and he's a goofball, but he's also very violent.
Yeah. And like when it first happens, it's so jarring. Yeah.
Well, Tim Blake Nelson makes me very uncomfortable.
Oh man.
Because of two films.
Yeah.
Colossal and the one with Jennifer Aniston and Jake Gyllenhaal.
Something boy. Good boy?
Good girl?
Good girl?
I don't know.
I was thinking of Bubble Boy.
Aren't we all? And yeah, just after that, like he already makes me uncomfortable. And
yeah, it's weird. And it is really jarring. Mm-hmm. And just like, whoa, like.
Yeah, and then like the last story, it's all these people riding on a carriage, and it has almost this like John Ford's Stagecoach feel, but then the plot of it is not at all like Stagecoach.
Awful, yeah. The last one I thought was pretty bad.
I don't know. I go back and forth on it because it's much different than anything else in the movie, and it doesn't really lay out exactly what's happening.
Yeah, I ranked them, and I can't entirely remember what my. I think I had the Jack London. Hemingway story is number one. That's the Tom Waits.
Oh, the gold.
Oh my God, it's so good, and it's perfect. It's lifted right out of the short story.
Yeah,
it's so great.
So it's an entertaining movie, and I appreciated the framing device that. I mean, without that, it's just six stories, but this way it feels a little bit more connected. Mm-hmm. And Kyle, what is your number three?
My number three is just the usual suspects. Mostly just because of who is framing the story. I don't want to get too much into it, but as if I could spoil a movie that old, but
I think there's other reasons we don't talk about the usual suspects.
Oh, yeah, that too. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot.
So I think you could probably spoil it, because more than likely people are either going to watch it in secret. Well, they're going to watch it in secret, or they're going to, like, you know, just read about it on Wikipedia. Yeah.
Well, they're not going to pin it on Kyle, that's for sure. That's
awesome. Sure. No, I mean, it would spoil further things, but I'd be curious to see how many movies or stories are told like this by the bad guy.
Yeah,
it's cool. Mm-hmm. And yeah, when it first came out, it was incredible.
I mean, as films go, it's a great film. It sucks that it's Kevin Spacey and the director. Like,
oh, I forgot Bryan Singer directed it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, never mind.
No, Kyle has nothing to do with you.
You know what, though? I love Benicio del Toro in that movie.
Oh, yeah. Man.
Flippy.
Flippy for real. Eva, what's your number three?
My number three is Bride of Frankenstein, which begins with not just any generic writer telling a story, but Elsa Lancaster, who shows up later as the bride, as Mary Shelley, who I think unfortunately, in the credits, she's Mrs. P. Shelley. And it starts with her and her friends telling a story. And that's where we pick up the sequel.
Nice.
Your number three?
So my number three is Twilight Zone Reboot. And it is the final episode, The Blurry Man. I'm not going to spoil anything. I haven't really given any of my take on the TZ reboot at all. It took me a while to figure out how to approach this.
I think we should just forget about it and
It's not going anywhere. And I think that people forget how the Twilight Zone, when it first started, the first season wasn't exactly like a critical hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I like a lot of the decisions that he made, and I think it's worth watching for sure. The last one has a framing device that is like, it's several layers deep.
This is the new Jordan Peele.
The new Jordan Peele. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like we're already dealing with a show that is encapsulated in a framing device, and then this one is like two added layers, and it deals a lot with kind of the history of the show. And
can we just say that I accurately predicted what it was about 5 minutes into the episode?
Oh, yeah,
and I was being facetious. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, great, now it's going to be this. And it was
it's definitely that.
That and, looked poorly. Yeah.
It's an interesting episode. It's like one of those love letters to the show that it's kind of like...
It should have ended about 30 seconds before
there
it
were a
ended.
Couple of them that needed to have ended sooner, and they would have been actually like really classic.
I didn't want
to
hear the blurry man talking.
There's
it was
a whole,
real weird.
Well, let's just say that if listeners remember why I hated the Tupac or Coachella hologram, then they can have it. That might give a clue as to what...
There's another trivia question.
Nick, what's your number two?
Three.
My number three, is I'm also going with a horror movie for my number three, and it is the Robert Vina film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Mm.
We've talked about it on the show a few times, so I'll be pretty quick, but I found on reading up on the story that it uses a very famous framing device, maybe the first cinematic unreliable narrator, if not the first one of them.
It's the first one that people in this century know of.
Yeah,
certainly.
Yeah, it's a key in terms of film history, framing device. It's a key unreliable narrator, and they referred to the framing story as Romanerzählung. It's the German word for it, but it's a story about a guy who is having someone else commit murders for him, and the framing device is actually set around someone who's telling the story, and then it turns out that his recounting of the story may not be exactly what happened.
What's so great about that framing device in that is it's not supposed to be there.
Yeah. Although, I read there were debates as to how much of that was supposed to be there, and they found old versions of the scripts, and some showed that there was a framing device there, but it wasn't the exact same.
Exactly.
It was like a framing device, but the very end was different, which...
The part of it that makes him unreliable was not supposed
right,
to be in there.
Which completely usurps the...
The message of the film.
Yeah. And a lot of it was like, how much were they able to get away with? But either way, like, the story itself is interesting, even taking out the kind of political implications of it.
You mean them trying to bury an anti-war film?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a very controversial film at the time. It was right after World War One. Mm-hmm. There were huge protests that American audience, they said, don't give your money to Germans. Do not see this German film. Mm-hmm. Don't go, you know, this is their, you know, it was, it's a really important film.
It's a story about PTSD. Mm-hmm. And you know, weren't the writers were veterans, right?
They were both World War One veterans. And it's about a young men in Europe being manipulated by older, powerful figures into killing. Yeah. And
I mean, horror is, it's that same political through line in the history of horror films.
Yeah. And just visually, it's one of the more influential movies ever made. If you haven't seen this, but you like, say, the early Tim Burton movies, I think it's a must watch because this is the type of thing that Tim Burton pulls from a lot. Like, Batman Returns is, I don't know that there's literal, like,
exact, well, it's German expressionism.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. I don't know that there's exact like things that are directly pulled from this movie, but that style of this and the early Murnau movies were the biggest influences on Tim Burton.
Yeah, and it's something where, you know, we're trying to create an environment in a film that is more about how the characters feel about where they are rather than like a natural portrayal of where they are.
Yeah.
I don't think there was much of that before that film.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not something that we see much now either.
No, it's only an hour long. You can watch something for an hour.
You can fly through it, and it's so old that everyone has the rights to it, so it's streaming pretty much anywhere. Mm-hmm. Kyle, what is your number two?
My number two is from a game called Foul Play, which came out in 2013. And this cool example of a framing device. It just falls under the category of just, I like how, it's just different. Basically you play as a character named Baron Dashforth, and the whole game takes place on a stage, like in a theater, and he's telling about his adventures and he's sitting in front of the audience, and then the curtain falls and then he's reenacting them on stage. And instead of having it's a side scrolling beat 'em up game, and instead of having a health bar for your character, you're playing for the audience's, like,
I think they're called Heath bars. For like chocolate and toffee.
Yeah. For their like how happy they are. And so if you get hit a lot, they'll like boo you and throw stuff at the stage. But if you beat up the enemies more, they'll like cheer more and be on your side. But I just like how the whole game is presented and how it's a different take on the story, how the story is told in the game. It's pretty cool. The game overall is really cool, and you can play it with two people at the same time. But yeah, Foul Play, my number two. Eva, what would be your number two?
Number two is The Company of Wolves. I think Sirs talked about this a little bit before.
Mm-hmm.
The Company of Wolves starts with a girl fighting with her sister. She gets mad. She runs upstairs to her room. She goes to sleep. She has a dream where her sister is killed by wolves. And then it's her and her grandmother, who's played by Angela Lansbury. And Angela Lansbury's character starts telling her these other stories about don't trust a man whose eyebrows meet in the middle, and other ways that you can tell who the wolves are. And so the rest of the film is the stories that grandma is telling her within her dream. So it's kind of a double or triple layer story. And it's a lot of stuff that I can't figure out why it isn't more popular. It's really gory and has a lot of great like wolf transformations. And
you know why it's not popular?
Why?
Because it talks a lot about toxic masculinity. And
oh, all yeah, there's that.
I thought you were going to say it's speaking ill of Anthony Davis.
His eyebrow.
They're right about unibrows. And, even Maggie has an enemy.
Maggie
with the conjoined brow. Eyebrows.
I've been trying to get you guys to do evil facial hair for...
Well, I feel like we covered some of it with, like... Because we've done, like, Mirror Spock. We haven't done.
We talked about Charles
hair.
Lawton's beard, and
yeah, when we did
Island
the one thing
Souls.
With like the deformed yeah. red hand.
Yeah, we've talked about in Community, which mm-hmm. I feel like is just coming up every episode now.
Right. That's because you're bringing it up.
Yeah, I'm not asking for you to bring it up.
You know, there's still time. I can find a way to squeeze an episode into my top five. So
I should tell you, though, that I'm the kind of person that the more you try to get me to watch something, I'm just not going to do it out of spite.
Oh, that's why he won't watch Paddington.
Yep.
Yeah. I've tried a couple times, and it's...
It's too charming?
Yeah, it's too charming.
It's too compelling and rich.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Oh, it's my turn.
It's your number two.
So my number two is from a great... great, great video game from 1995 called Comics Zone, released for the second time.
Nice. Nick throws his hands in the air for the second time.
Yep.
I'm pumping both fists in the air.
Great. Like, I don't really know what the story was about. All I know is it's like a comic book artist is making a comic book, and you are playing the superhero that he's drawing as
still does, pumping his fist.
Doesn't he get sucked into his own?
He's kind of like
his own work.
He does.
Okay, you're playing
the bad
actual
guy. Yeah, the bad guy. I don't know how you switch places, but he is the one writing the villains for you to fight.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Man, that's great.
I don't remember how it happens. I think it's probably the typical thunderstorm, electrocution, something happens.
It's like really generic. Yeah. So you're just running around as this souped up, really generic looking
Trip
kind of superhero. And man, it's so great.
His name.
I think like one of the coolest things about it, like the graphics were like really ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it features all of this really explosive artwork of you jumping out of pages. And
you would like jump from panel to panel.
Yeah.
You'd punch enemies through like the panels, and it was awesome.
Oh, it's just great. Yeah, Comic Zone was one of the best video games Sega made.
Sketch Turner.
His name was
better.
Trip Turner.
Sketch.
Sketches are pretty great name.
It's so great. Yeah, so we need that movie to come out. Maybe like Warner Brothers can do it or something. One of the studios with barely any money left. Because of Disney.
So good.
So yeah, listeners, if you can find an emulator or something, look up Comic
Zone.
Weren't they going to release a version of it for
the Switch? Yeah, maybe. They never like redo it. I think they just poured it over.
Yeah,
which I support because I don't think it could be updated.
Well, there are Sega collections that it's on. So I think it is on the Switch. I don't know. It might just be part of a collection.
Nice. So that's my number two. Nick, what is your number two?
My number two, I originally had this as my number one, but I'm dropping it down to my number two, and when I get to my number one, I'll explain why. But my number two, it's another one of those ones where like Rashomon was something where after that happened, so many other stories wanted to use that, like the way that framing device was. And I think this movie that's my number two is maybe even more so since it was so popular and remains so popular. So many times when you have a biopic, it's told in this way. And the movie I'm picking is Citizen Kane. And it is the story of, at the beginning, Charles Foster Kane dies. And it's about a journalist who's trying to figure out what Rosebud meant. It was his last word. And he goes to like these archives, and he reads about his history as a child and as a young man, and then he meets with one of Kane's former coworkers and friends, and then he meets with one of his ex-wives. So the movie itself is divided up into these different chapters where it's somebody who's actually going through, and that's why everything's being told in a flashback. He's trying to learn more about this person. And it's just that type of device. I mean, it's not the most interesting thing about the movie by any means, but since the movie was so good in every other aspect as well, it's just something that so many people are pulling from now. So it's a really common, you know, framework for telling a movie, but this probably does it better than any of them. I mean, there's a reason that it's so well regarded. It's just it's an amazing movie.
Did you bump it to number two to make room for that John Travolta Gotti movie?
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't have to include it now.
Man.
Kyle, what is your number one?
Sega Genesis Classics is what Comic Zone is on the nice. Switch. Came out end of last year. There were 49 other games, but the asking price is probably worth Comic Zone is probably worth the asking price by itself. My number one is a game I'll definitely need to retire from my list because I talk about it a lot. But it is, it might be my favorite indie game of all time, What Remains of Edith Finch. And it's just Edith returning home to this house that she grew up in. And as she explores the house, she recounts all of these tragic stories of how each one of her family members died. And you play through them. And they're all like really fantastical and change up gameplay elements. And they kind of pretty up the stories a little bit. But you're hearing the story while you're playing it. And you, when you finish the short segment, you come to the conclusion that, like, yeah, they didn't survive. And it's like really dark, but also beautiful. And it's such an amazing game. It actually just came out for the Switch this year sometime. But yeah, it's really good. Kind of depressing, but yeah. Unique framing device. Lots of stories told in this game. Eva, what would be your number one?
My number one is an anthology film, a lot like the Twilight Zone episodes, where we have somebody outside of the story kind of guiding us in and out of these stories to keep us from getting scared too much, maybe, or to reassure us that this is just a story, this isn't really happening. Kind of like a ferryman, you know, through the underworld, except instead of a man smoking cigarettes, it's the disembodied head of George Clinton, and he's got three eyes. And it's a HBO film from 1994 called Cosmic Slop, which somehow I only found out about last summer, which I was, much like Company of Wolves, is like, what have I been doing with my whole life before I saw this? And it's three short stories. I think there's two of them that I like a lot more than the third one. It's been buried. I think it was released on VHS. It has not been seen since. And it's not for lack of quality. It's because of the tone of the stories that they're like, nope, we can't talk about this anymore. And it needs to come back. You can find the stories if you look hard enough. I heartily recommend them.
It was a TV movie, it looks like.
Yep.
Yep, HBO film. And essentially it is it's a black anthology, black sci-fi slash kind of, it's more sci-fi than horror. There is a
space
horror
traders
element. Yeah. It's basically like more than, say, like Tales from the Hood.
Yes.
Specifically horror, whereas Cosmic Slop has like a couple of really great sci-fi stories in it. Really interesting. A couple of the stories are really old.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're some of them are written like in the '40s and adapted to now.
That's the third one, right?
Yeah, Plan B. Mm-hmm.
It came out the same year as PCU.
Oh, wow.
So George Clinton had a big year that year.
Well, the sad part is because George Clinton doesn't make any money off of the music he's made, George Clinton has to keep working.
Mm-hmm.
And thus his appearance in film. And he's still on tour. So, sir, what's your number one?
So, my number one is from the Batman cartoon that everybody's forgotten about. So there was the Batman the Animated Series that like everyone loves and won all the awards. And then there was one that they tried called the New Adventures of Batman, or the New Animated. It's called the New Batman and Robin. In any case, most of the episodes were kind of subpar compared to the original, except there was one really good one called Legends of the Dark Knight. And essentially, three Gotham kids, and they're, you know, your typical Gotham kids. If you're in Gotham, you're either the child of billionaires or an orphan. So they're kind of wandering around, and there's an arsonist that's loose in town, and they kind of run across evidence of it, and then they start telling stories about what Batman's going to do when he finds him. So the first kid tells a story about Batman as this kind of half-man, half-bat creature, and the second story is stylized in the same way that the 60s and 70s comic books were. So it's Batman is really goofy. It's Batman and Robin. And the artwork is like really fun and cartoonish. And, you know, the Joker is swinging a big mallet and that sort of thing. And then the third one is the first time The Dark Knight Returns was on
was on screen. So Dark Knight Returns is a classic graphic novel, Batman graphic novel, and the kid tells this dystopian story about, you know, Batman is this like older hulking kind of ultra-violent superhero, and it's lifted from Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. And yeah, that's the, as far as I know, the first time it was on screen. So yeah, it's a really cool anthology, like little mini anthology, and it shows kind of who Batman is to these like kids and how they all have this different concept of him. And of course he shows up in real life and rescues them from whatever villain is at play. So yeah, that's my favorite of this example. Nick, what is your number one?
My number one is the 2018 American biographical crime film about New York City mobster John Gotti. It's called Gotti. It has a 0% on Rotten Tomatoes. Mm-hmm. No, that's not actually my number one.
But only in your heart.
But I did watch it, though.
Huh? You watched it,
yeah.
As did I.
I've heard it's just bad, not fun bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I...
It's weird because it, like... There was that Armand DeSante Gotti movie that people talk about as being good. I'd actually seen that. I watched that like a week before. They're the same. You could even possibly argue that the John Travolta one is a little better because it is more fun. Like the Armand DeSante one is way too serious and it's horrible. Mm-hmm. It's so bad. And I think it won like an Emmy for it. And yet the new one is...
It shows that it is a movie that has been in development for a very long time with very many people trying to steer it.
Mm-hmm. So my real number one, the reason I'm putting this as my number one over Citizen Kane, I might be doing this side project with some people that I'm in like a Facebook film group with, and they brought up the idea of doing like a draft of just like best movies of the decade. They just told me about it yesterday. So I've been thinking like there's a best of list I could make, but I already know what I want to pick as my number one. And it's maybe not my favorite movie of the decade, but it's, Paddington 2. And I would pick that because even though it's maybe not my favorite or the best, it's the one that like I feel the most personal about, like it's one that I'm championing. So my number one over Citizen Kane, just because Citizen Kane, like everyone knows about Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like not enough people have seen the movie that we've reviewed on the old incarnation of this show. That's Holy Motors.
Mm.
Because I love the framing device of this guy who's just in a limo. He's being driven around by Edith Scobe. And it's just a whole bunch of different vignettes where he's playing different roles of very strange. Like he's an old beggar woman, and then he does motion capture, like sort of sex, but it's also like dragons or something like that, if I remember right. And
the accordion scene.
He plays Let My Baby Ride, the R.L. Burnside mm-hmm. song, on the accordion. He plays a father who like picks his daughter up from a party, and at the party they're listening to Kylie Minogue, and then later he does a duet with Kylie Minogue. And it's just one of the weirdest movies from the last decade, but I have a blast with it. I think it's really fun. And I love the framing device of it's just this guy who's playing different roles.
Mm-hmm. Are they connected at all? I don't remember. Like, is there a smooth transition or any sort of thing?
Really,
I don't think so. Not really.
Super weird.
But it's a movie that I feel like
you need to tell people about it.
Yeah.
You're like the evangelist for like Holy Motors.
Like, Moonlight won Best Picture. Like, I love Moonlight. I think it's one of the best movies of the decade. Yeah, right. But like,
you're going to get that from somebody else.
Yeah, Moonlight's not a secret. This movie, it feels like it's something that, you know, we didn't discover it, but I didn't hear a lot of people talking about it. It's just a movie that I have, like, a strong personal attachment to because of...
It's like Birds of Passage for me this past couple of years, man. I wish everybody would see that.
I need to see that still.
Oh, it's so good.
I've seen Embrace of the Serpent, and I liked that. I think that made my list.
Embrace of the Serpent.
So, one of my lists that we've done. I can't remember what episode, but anyways, Holy Motors, I love it, and I feel very, like, I feel personal affection for that movie.
I think what hurts Holy Motors for me specifically is that I can never remember the name of it. I think naming a movie like that is hard, but for some reason I remember that movie very well, but I cannot remember the name a lot of the time. I'll try to think of it and I can't.
It's just called Holy Motors. I was going to say, I wonder if the French title, but
Did you see it in theaters or did you Were you able to?
No, I don't even know why we...
How we
came...
How you got there.
Yeah. Was it like on streaming? Or was it on some streaming?
It was on Netflix, service, but it's not the type of movie that we...
What's the type of movie that you would have heard about? I think you told us about it.
Yeah, but I... Like, we all watched it for reviewing it, but I don't remember, like, why we thought to do it. We weren't doing a lot of reviews.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It found you.
I kind of feel that way. Yeah. Found me, and it scooped me up, and...
It happens.
With Eva Mendes, and took us into the sewer, and here we are.
And then danced a little bit.
It's one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah. And Edith Scope just passed away in like the last month or two, I think.
Yeah, like this summer. And she even puts on the mask at the end. That will also be a trivia question next month. So those are our top five lists. We do have a new Patreon subscriber. You can follow us at patreon.com/onthetropes. It is Papa C20X6, or is it 20x6? I'm assuming it's 20x6. Like 20x6. You know?
Maybe.
I can't argue with you.
Do you need the answer?
Some kind of like track bed measurement, I'm guessing.
I'm wondering, if, like, do you guys know what a 20x6 is? It's not like a sheet of paper.
Nah.
11x14. Anyways.
Reveal yourself to us, Papa C. Explain your numbers.
They say Eve is a good addition to the podcast. She brings strong energy, new insights. So thank you for your support. You can also find us at... Patreon.com/onthetropes. You can find us at facebook.com/onthetropes and on Twitter. You can email us at onthetropes@gmail.com, and you can buy our stuff. The new link, onthetropes.redbubble.com.
That's right.
Man. Way easier. And it's always been that?
It's always been that.
Gosh.
We were just going the long way.
We made it way too hard. You had to earn it, I feel like. The people who've already used it,
it was an adventure.
They put the effort in.
Yeah.
But
they got something to show.
But no longer. On the tropes.
Those people have integrity.
Yeah, on the tropes.redbubble.com if you get tired typing. That's where to go. Anyways, I've been Nick.
I've been Sir.
Eva.
And Kyle.
And join us again next week. We're talking about...
Tropes.
The circus.
We're going to the circus.
Going to the circus.